and Ken Jones. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineers are Ray Bodwell and Carmina Flores. Special thanks to Lauren Schmidt, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Zamone Perez, and Mark Moran. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jezaniah Hawthorne.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Street Roots reporter Jake Thomas to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called Coming Up Empty. A state board in Oregon tried to take steps towards regulating drug prices. It's been unable to accomplish its central tasks. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Your new story talks about Oregon's Prescription Drug Affordability Board, or PDAB, and its relative lack of action up until this point. Let's start by talking about what this board is and what it's supposed to do.
So this board is there's about 12 boards like it in states across the United States. And they were set up because the federal government has not done a lot to control the price of drugs or really to take meaningful action. So these were set up to sort of guide state policy on increasing on affordable prescription drugs. And a lot of these boards are pretty different in how they're structured and what kind of authority they have. There's about four of them have what's called an upper payment limit, which is just really a technical term for having a price cap on a drug that's been that the board has determined to be too expensive. I know when legislators were considering setting up Oregon's PDAB, they considered giving it this authority as well, but they have not. So yeah, Oregon's board doesn't have those powers to set price caps. And so right now, when it was set up in 2021, it was set up with basically just reviewing data on prescription drugs and putting out these reviews, which are basically just really detailed reports about pretty common prescription drugs and just showing like how much they've increased in cost and if there's or less expensive alternatives as well. So they have a lot of information in these reports. But the big job that the board has, according to statute, is they have to identify 9 prescription drugs and an insulin product as being potentially unaffordable for patients and healthcare systems. It seems like it'd be a pretty easy job to do just to find 9 drugs that are maybe too expensive. But the board has really struggled to do that just because of the complexity of the work and just really finding out how much these drugs actually cost, because a lot of it is concealed by these negotiations between drug manufacturers and insurance companies and benefit plans. And so it's really figuring out like just what drugs cost and which ones really have problems with affordability has been pretty elusive for the board.
Well, you mentioned that Oregon isn't the only state to have a drug affordability board. Have there been successes in other states?
I guess the one depending on who you ask, Colorado is considered the one that is the farthest along with their work. Colorado's board was set up in the same year that Oregon's was, and the legislation was passed in 2021 and it was set up in 2022. So Colorado's board has really taken probably the most direct action at drug prices by enacting a price cap on the drug Enbrel, which is a pretty common drug to use to treat rheumatoid arthritis. And so they placed this price cap, saying that Novi and the state is going to pay this much money for this drug.
How has the pharmaceutical industry responded to these PDABs?
So in Colorado, they really were opposed to the Colorados when they were enacting the price limit or the price cap. They Amgen, the maker of the drug, sued Colorado's PDAB. Colorado's PDAB won in court. It is being appealed, so we're going to see how that plays out. But in Oregon, they've been very critical of the work of Oregon's PDAB. They've really just been very critical of the methodology that the board has been considering to evaluate drugs. And they said that they just haven't done enough to listen to patients and have not done enough outreach. And so they've been really, like, pretty much every time the board meets that you have people from representing drug makers and pharma showing up to these meetings and speaking out against what they're doing.
To be clear, speaking out against actions that haven't been taken, right? Because Oregon's PDAB hasn't identified those 9 drugs and that one insulin product that are overpriced. Is that right?
Yes, they've been very critical of the board for it hasn't really done a whole lot. I mean, to be fair, I talked to the board's chair, Shirley Bailey. She defended the board's work. I mean, they've done a lot of research on drugs, and they've done these affordability reviews. And these reviews, they have a lot of information in them, and they would be really useful if you were, like, trying to develop a benefits plan, if you're an employer. So it's not as if they've done nothing. But one of the big steps is identifying these 9 drugs and one insulin product that poses affordability challenges. Like, that was like the one of the central goals, because once you identify those drugs as being potentially unaffordable, they're just being excessively expensive, then the legislature would have really good information that they could do a lot of things with. They could pass legislation, they pass some sort of legislation that's aimed at making these drugs less costly. And they could even give the board the power to do a price cap or an upper payment limit if they really think that these drugs, if it's that big of a problem, these drugs are that expensive. So really doing these identifying these 9 drugs and one insulin product as being excessively expensive would be seen as a precursor to having these price caps on them.
So they haven't done that yet, and that's kind of a problem. You mentioned in the article that the vice chair has even called for the group to disband because of this lack of action. What are some of the challenges that the PDAB has faced in getting this done?
So the big one, so they have done a lot of work, but I think the big problem that they have is really understanding the true cost of a prescription drug. Because what the drug industry will do, what a lot of drug makers will do, is they'll put out the list price of a drug. And it looks really expensive, but then that's just like the sticker price. But then, but it often doesn't reflect the actual price of it, because drug makers will have all these rebates, and they'll have discounts, and they'll have all these other price concessions that they'll give to health insurance plans. And then they also give a lot of these drugs, they discount pretty heavily for patients. So like the list price, we have a really high list price for this drug, but finding out like how much the drug actually costs is really difficult to do, because that is really closely guarded trade secret information.
You bring up in the article as well that because this is trade secret information, that the sticker price is high, but there's rebates or knockdowns that the public doesn't necessarily know about. This is something that has been difficult for the board to even access or talk about because of public meeting law. Can you talk about that part?
So Oregon has this really unusual, I don't think any other state has it, but we have this really weird quirk in our public meetings law. And that's basically just a law that says that if you're a school board or city council or state panel or commission or board or anything like this, that you have to just make your decisions out in the open. You can't go behind closed doors. That's basically what the law does. But the law allows these state officials to go behind closed doors in what's called executive session. And that's basically for really sensitive stuff like litigation, for personnel, for things like that, that you just really can't have out in the open, that you do need to give officials a chance to just have, a candid conversation about sensitive matters. But in Oregon, what's allowed is members of the press are allowed to sit in on these executive sessions with the understanding that they don't report anything out of these sessions. And the whole idea of that is that if you have a reporter sitting in on an executive session, you're not, and somebody's watching you, you're not going to be abusing it. You're not going to be going into executive session and talking about things that you should be talking about in the open. This could be a problem for the work of PDAB because they might go into executive session to discuss proprietary trade secrets of the drug industry that would give them some insights into what the true price of a medication is. And so just having like a reporter present just for these just to be discussed at all, because it just makes all of them uncomfortable. And so that's been a real barrier to doing this work.
With this sort of press exception, is there any reason to believe that journalists would take this sensitive information and spread it around?
As a reporter, you wouldn't want to do this, because if you did this, if you reported something that was an executive session, it would really hurt you reputationally. You would be seen as unethical. You'd be seen as untrustworthy. Using the laws, you would be the one, the person that's like blamed for changes to this law, to not having this this unique provision that allows reporters to sit in executive session. So I think it is really based on trust, and I don't think that any reporter would really want to violate that, because it is a very important, I think most reporters view it as a very, very sacred responsibility of sitting in on these executive sessions. And I think if they went out and blabbed something, then I think they would just be really reluctant to do that, because it would just be such a reputational hit. But at the same time, I, in fairness, I can understand to agree with the challenges of PDAB, because I mean, this isn't just like, they're talking about some lawsuit or something just routine. They're talking about like really high level trade secrets for some gigantic corporations. And I see where they're coming from, that maybe a reporter could blab somebody, their editor, and they could blab, and just somehow this could leak out. I mean, I think it's a little bit far-fetched, but I just think with the stakes we're talking about, I do understand it, their concerns. But I really don't think reporters would do this. I think it is unfounded.
So what are some possible solutions to this stagnation at the Prescription Drug Affordability Board?
When I talked to the chair, the chair said, Shelley Bailey, she said that they're going to continue to do work on this, and they're just going to do the best they can with the data they have. They are going to put out this, they're planning in January of next year to vote on designating designating drugs as being unaffordable or potentially unaffordable. And that will, that'd be a pretty big step forward for the board. As far as over the public meetings law, they can do some things, like they can prohibit reporters from recording things, which I think is fair. And every time I've sat in an executive session, I've never made a recording of it. So I think that they could do that. So they could do some things to kind of safeguard this. But it is like a real challenge.
What do you hope readers and listeners take away from this story?
I hope they take away from the story is just how, like, everybody knows that prescription drugs are really expensive. But I'd hope that they would understand that there is like some efforts on the state level to try to address the cost of prescription drugs and just how complicated this works, because all this is just so complicated and so opaque that just trying to get like some kind of idea of what's driving the cost of this and what can be done about it is just gets stymied just by the sheer complexity of it.
If folks are interested, where can they find out more? Read this for themselves.
Go and find your vendor, for a street roots vendor.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
That was Jake Thomas, Street Roots reporter, speaking with me about his latest story for the paper. It's called Coming Up Empty, a state board in Oregon tried to take steps towards regulating drug prices. It's been unable to accomplish its central tasks. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The start of November brings two of our favorite annual events in Portland: the Portland Book Festival, which we previewed on yesterday's News In Depth with director Amanda Bullock, and the Portland Youth Philharmonic season opening concert, both taking place this Saturday, November 8th. PYP is America's longest-running youth orchestra, dating back to 1924. They'll be launching their 102nd season at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall with a concert titled Rising Winds. The program includes two pieces by Australian-born composer Percy Grainger, the Duke of Marlborough Fanfare and Lincolnshire Posy, Mexican composer Gabriela Ortiz's La Calaca, and to top it off, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, a.k.a. The Emperor. In what's become an annual tradition for me, we're fortunate to have David Hattner, PYP's musical director, to preview the historic 102nd season opener. David, I'd like to start off with a little historical context. I was in Eastern Oregon last week, visiting friends and family in Pendleton and Athena. My wife grew up there, and it got me thinking of PYP, which actually has its roots in that area, though a lot of the people I talked to didn't realize it.
Well, the orchestra is actually, its prehistory goes to Harney County, a little south of there, and Mary Dodge, the violinist who ended up starting the Junior Symphony, was sent to Harney County around 1910 with her then husband, who was a civil engineer. They were trying to work on irrigation for the ranchers. And she started an orchestra made up of local young people with donated instruments. And they even sent it on a little tour to Salem and Portland back then. And she eventually moved back to Portland and taught in the schools. And soon she had enough students to start thinking about having a full orchestra, which they formed with the conductor Jacques Krzyzkowicz starting in the fall of 1924.
So I wanted to get to Saturday's concert. It's called Rising Winds in the program. I was wondering, is that a play on the coming of winter and maybe showcasing the wind instruments in the orchestra?
Perhaps. The marketing titles for the concerts, I only make suggestions.
they come up with some good ones.
Yes. The musicians are rising musicians, and we are, for the first time in 101-plus seasons, playing a work that's actually scored for band. We've played works for winds before. You've heard several of them for the orchestra winds, just through regular flutes, oboes, clarinets, bassoons, and so forth. But this is actually concert band with euphoniums and saxophones and full percussion. And it's a historical work from the 1930s, and it plays a big role in the history of the concert band. It was the first time a serious modern composer wrote using modern metrical complexity that Stravinsky had used in The Rite of Spring in a band work. And it was quite baffling to the people who were first assigned to play it. But now colleges and universities and even high schools play it with some regularity.
And that's Percy Grainger's piece, right? Lincolnshire Posy?
That's right, Lincolnshire Posy, a souvenir of folk singers he studied while he was in England. He was Australian, and he spent time in England. He lived in the United States for a long time, but in the early 1900s, he traveled through the Lincolnshire region carrying an Edison phonograph to authentically and permanently capture the folk singers with all of their nuance. Folk songs in classical music had mostly been notated with pencil on paper. Any unusual tones were corrected, any unusual harmonies were corrected, and they were written, usually in 4-4 or 3-4 or, some normal meter. Even if the singer sang in a very wayward way, it was corrected by the composer. And Grainger did not want to do this. He wanted it to have the real emotional impact of the actual performance by completely untrained musicians who had learned from tradition these songs. For the most part, they were recorded on Edison cylinders, and then he worked on really ennobling them with fantastic harmonies and orchestration. It's really an extraordinary piece that most people will never have heard in a concert if they're from Portland, because it's just played so rarely in this town, probably never at the show.
But I read it has a personal connection for you going back to high school.
Well, playing it, yes, going back to high school, but knowing about it even further back, because when I was in middle school, I played the first piece I'd ever played by Percy Grainger, a very small piece. And the conductor of that told us there was this great big piece called Lincolnshire Posy that was so difficult only college students could play it, and that we should find out more about it. And so when I returned home, I made a request at the radio station. They used to have request night on classical radio. And so they played it, and I taped it, and I listened to it so many times, and it was hard to believe that less than 2 years after that, I was playing it in a band in 10th grade.
You played clarinet.
Played clarinet on it, bass clarinet of various parts. And once I graduated from college, you know, you don't really play much band music anymore after that, unless you're in a military band. So I didn't have a chance to play it. I certainly heard it many times, but it occurred to me that it was one of the pieces I really would like to do. And there was no reason I couldn't find a way to do it with our orchestra winds, some members of our other ensembles, and some guest musicians for some of the parts like euphonium and some of the saxophone parts. We have a few musicians who are just joining us only for this piece.
Now, David, you've been a champion of women composers at PYP. And man, I have a list here, which doesn't include them all. Ruth Gibbs, Lily Boulanger, Amy Beach, Lara Auerbach, Polina Nazikinskaya, Valerie Coleman, among others. And now this program features Gabriela Ortiz, a contemporary Mexican composer. How did her work come to your attention?
Well, her name came to my attention many times just from looking at what other orchestras are doing around the world. And it seemed like she was writing a lot of really big pieces. Like I know Dudamel did nearly an hour-long piece for a giant orchestra and a small vocal ensemble and various other things. And I would hear parts of these pieces, and they're so impressive. Like her music is just impressive. It's big, it's strong, it's complex, and very difficult. So I was looking through for something that originally I was going to pair it with a piece that's now on a separate program this year, Aaron Copland's El Salón, Mexico, which is a souvenir of a visit he made to Mexico City. But I couldn't fit them on the program together for one reason or another. So they're at opposite ends of the season. We're still doing the Copland piece. It's this year is Copland's 125th anniversary, by the way. So I wanted to have an authentic Mexican piece. And I've already done Carlos Chavez in the past and Revueltas last year. So I thought we should do somebody living. And she seemed like the most interesting composer that fit on this program. I wanted to have something for the winds, something for the strings, and because the Beethoven that we'll talk about doesn't use every instrument of the modern orchestra. It doesn't have trombones, for instance. So I wanted them to have something really interesting to play. And then to give the strings something to really shine on and prepare them for the season. And this piece, La Calaca, is doing just that. It is exceptionally difficult and complex, both metrically and technically. So it's very hard for me, as a matter of fact. It has a lot of difficult meter changes, and it's been a challenge. But we played it last night, and I thought it sounded really good. I was impressed. They're extraordinary musicians, the members of our string sections. And so, if you want to hear a very impressive composer, like something that's really going to be, wow, that's really something, because it starts out rather dissonant and aggressive, and it ends with a folk song that, you know, sounds more like something somebody would sing at the end. So it repeats a lot of times, so it's got a lot of excitement. I think it's great.
And it's very timely. The piece is La Calaca, which Spanish slang calaca is for skeleton or skull. So the work is perfect for the week of Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, which is celebrated in Mexico the first 2 days of November. So it's very appropriate for this time of year, in addition to all the other reasons you gave us.
That's right. It is all of that is referenced in the score, that it's perfect for this particular Mexican holiday.
Now, the next one I've been excited about since I heard you were going to do it when you revealed the program for the 102nd season. And it's more familiar to classical music lovers, Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, the fifth and final of his piano concertos. Absolutely beautiful piece of music, especially the second movement. I first heard PYP, and you know this, when you featured Beethoven's other fifth, the Fifth Symphony, and still remember how stirring and moving it was. I was hooked. So there's so many ways for a conductor to interpret Beethoven's work. Do you have a certain approach?
I always try to deal with what's there and not the the literary or the historical placement of it. When we did the fifth, I probably told you this, I wanted to make sure that we thought about it and studied it not as musicians who had heard 6, 7, 8, and 9, plus the Rite of Spring, plus all the Brahms symphonies. Like, okay, it's we do know all those, but if we look at it from the standpoint of this is when he wrote it, it was his most contemporary work and cannot possibly reference things that he had not composed yet. It comes out a little fresher, I think. And so it's the same for this. It's by any standard a giant concerto. It's long. There are longer concertos, but not very many that are significantly longer for any instrument. And it's an unusual concerto even for Beethoven, because there's so much of it that it's sort of like a technical etude for the piano, just scales, arpeggios, and this sort of thing. But yet it's highly ennobled by all the things that he does with these materials. And for whatever reason, everyone's just always loved it. And it got this funny title, Emperor, somewhere along the line that it can't shake. And so the pieces of Beethoven's that have a name, audiences seem to love those the best. I'm excited about doing it. And, you know, the other thing I always do is just follow the lead of our soloist and frame all the things we're going to do around what she's doing.
Right. I want to talk about her. It's Lucy Ju, and she's the winner of the 2025 Portland Piano International Concerto Competition, which is a PYP tradition featuring the competition winner each year. Lucy, I read, joined PYP when she was just 10 years old. Can you talk about her and your experience with Lucy in the orchestra?
Well, she's been in our cello section a little while, and she's been in, you know, quiet presence there. And when I found out she was a soloist finalist for the piano concerto competition, I thought, oh, this is great, you know, because more than once in the past, a member of the orchestra has won the competition. I can't remember the last one who did it. It may go all the way back to the 90th season when Hannah Moon played the Grieg concerto. But we've had a couple. And, you know, I heard the competition and I thought there were many very good players. And I was excited for Lucy when she was declared the winner, and excited for us because we get to play this marvelous Beethoven concerto, which, you know, everyone loves to play Beethoven. And but it required some careful programming because it is an entire half of a concert that does not include the trombones, that does not include most of the percussion section and other things. So we had to program so that those players get something to play on the other half. So all those things happened.
Now, one last question, and this was a surprise to me, but a very happy one. In Willamette Week's recent 2025 Best of Portland Readers Poll, PYP was voted Best Musical Group. You beat out a rock band called Pilot and a bluegrass band called the Bridge City Sinners. It's so well-deserved, David, but it must have been something of a surprise to you, too.
Well, we're thrilled to be nominated. And, you know, we didn't exactly run a Grammy-level campaign to get people to vote for us. But we did, you know, we sent the social media around and wrote to people, said, please, you know, like, this is an interesting opportunity. And we do feel like the people who know us really appreciate us. The general public maybe has a little less PYP on the brain than 50, 60 years ago, because there's so much other music in Portland now. There's so many big professional organizations and other groups doing so many interesting things. But here we are in our 102nd season, you know, sort of chugging along, doing what we've always done. We feel like we're doing it as well as we ever have done it. And we do it without importing talent, generally speaking. The people are from here. It's an opportunity that's for the children of the people who live and work here. So it's really, like, of all the things that happen musically, like, it is one of the most Portland things, although much of the music is imported. We're just super proud of that, and we're about to settle into a new home for the orchestra, the former Central Lutheran Church on Northeast 21st and Schuyler is now the property of PYP, and we'll be refurbishing it over the next several months and moving into it at some point and doing our rehearsals and some of our performing there. So we're no longer itinerant. It's like, so this is a great time to hear the orchestra and either learn about or be reminded of how much it has inspired people for so many years with the music that it plays, and most importantly, the way that it prepares and performs it.
Right, going back 102 years. Well, David, again, thanks so much for talking with us and previewing Saturday's concert. Wishing you and PYP a very happy 102nd.
Thank you, Ken. Well, enjoy the concert.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, now in its 102nd year. The orchestra's season opening concert takes place this Saturday, November 8th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets at portlandyouthphil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Saturday at 10 p.m. for Queery. Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.